Wonderful Shabbat. Welcome to our program. It was yesterday that we learned the delightful news that the Crown Prince of Evil was killed. Exterminated might be the right term. It is amazing, though, that between the leader of Hell's demons and the political leader of Israel, Yahya Sinwar and Netanyahu, that Jews are still unable and unwilling to say Yahweh's name. Nonetheless, the Crown Prince of Evil, the ugly tooth one, was suitably killed. He had his right hand completely blown off. He had his left knee completely blown off. And he was sitting in a pile of rubble, anguishing there all alone. He had the idea of a UN school teacher as his bodyguard on him, which is pretty tough for the UN to swallow and explain. But nonetheless, a UN official was his bodyguard. But both of the Islamic terrorists that were around him both abandoned him. He was sitting there all alone in the very squalor that he had invited on his fellow Muslims in Gaza. And he, without a right hand and without a left knee, anguishing there in this sheer squalor, dust everywhere, he throws a stick at the drone that had come to investigate the scene. And the next we see him, he's buried under a pile of rubble. There is a bullet hole to the left side of his face. We don't see the exit wound, but we have his left temporal lobe. It is completely blown up. And it proves the thing that I've said about Muslims for a long time. They're brainless. There is no brain matter, not even any blood that comes out of this golf ball, well, not golf ball, it's baseball sized hole in this moron's head. Nothing in there, just nothing but an empty cavity. It is a telling that Muslims are saying, oh, he died as a hero, throwing a statue at that dastardly drone. Yeah, if that's your hero, a man who sent terrorists to torture little children, to gang rape little girls, duck men and women, and to commit acts of mass murder and grotesque, sadistic tortures. If that is your hero, you are one sick son of a bitch.
Yes.
And then, of course, the new spokespeople for Hamas brag and says, you know, martyrs never die. Well, they're right, but he doesn't know how right they are. They are eternal. That's the whole major appeal. You get to live forever in what is the equivalent of a black hole, which is where all of these Islamic terrorists will spend eternity. But just think how stupid, how immoral you have to be to actually be conned into believing that there is a God who is going to reward rapists, thieves, terrorists, and murderers with heavenly rewards, where you'll have multiple virgins that you'll be able to take to satiate your carnal desires for eternity. It takes a special kind of stupid to buy into that, and that is the nature of Islam. It's the reason why I rewrote Prophet of Doom into the 5 volumes of Goddamn Religion. I understand the new site for it is very, very close to being ready to publish, which means we can start advertising Goddamn Religion. It is essential reading for everyone worldwide, so they, we understand the nature of this curse and know that the battle against the very survival of Israel and to avoid Jewish genocide against God's people, the only way to deal with it is to understand the nature of the enemy, and the enemy is not Hamas, not Hezbollah, it's not Iran, it's not the Houthi Houthis, it is Islam. It's not a corruption of Islam, it is pure Islam, it's the Islam of Muhammad. Muhammad began his career against Jews by perpetrating genocide on the Jews of Arabia. He did the same thing that the Ghazian Muslims did. He and his goons murdered the men en masse. They played a game of lots to gang rape the women, and then they enslaved the children after stealing their property. This is the nature of the most disgusting religion in the history of humanity, and there's a lot of candidates for disgusting religion. It just happens to be the worst. But it was prophetic that he would die in an armchair, since his most famous picture was his defiant picture sitting in an armchair with his blown-up home in the background, showing really the destruction that he has brought upon his own people. It also is interesting that you have this argument now by progressives saying, well, now that you've killed Sinwar, this is your golden opportunity to end the war. Why? Are the hostages returned? Has Hamas laid down their arms? Have they surrendered? No. They're saying they will continue to fight. For what? For Fakistan? For genocide against Jews? To obliterate Israel? What are they fighting for? But they said they're going to continue to fight. They want more martyrs. I think Israel should accommodate them, personally. But there's no end to this. It will never end. Well, it will end when the Yahweh returns, but that's 9 years from now. There is no end in sight for man. We are going to return to where we began this program last week. We were beginning to analyze the story of the Red Heifer. And we're actually going to go back to the beginning, because this week, as I was able to gather more information to set the proper foundation to understand the story of the Red Heifer, I was just overwhelmed with information. And we're going to need to go back to it, both linguistically to understand the nature of why Yada, as the Zeroa, the one cultivating the final harvest, is proclaimed to be the Parah by Isaiah, Yeshayah. And then we're going to turn to the last prophetic revelation that Yahweh offered humankind. It's the fourth and final chapter of Malachi, Malachi, because it speaks specifically of this event. We will go back through the prophecy of the Adamah Parah, the Red Heifer, and as we do that, we will come out on the other side with two essential prophecies. One is talked about in the song that we're going to play that Dee wrote for this evening, called The Man from Edom, predicting again this very event and my role as the Red Heifer. And then we will also go through and detail the dress rehearsal for this. You see, just as there was a dress rehearsal for Pesach Passover between Abraham and Yitzhak and Yahweh on Mount Moriah exactly 40 years ago, before goats fulfilled Pesach Matzah and Bukurim, in exactly the same place, there is a dress rehearsal for the Red Heaven. The same man orchestrated the proceedings. He was the master of ceremonies, which means that the funeral of the Red Heifer is going to be very, very funny. Normally, I would I hate funerals so much I'd miss my own funeral, but not this one. This one, I'm going to be there because Eliyahu is a very, very funny man. And so I know how long he's been practicing this because I did the math. His dress rehearsal and the main event are separated by 40 or about 888 years. So he's had lots of time to work on his craft, and we should expect to be absolutely entertained. So we have a lot of material to go through, and then eventually on the far side of this, we're going to come out with the story of the adulterous woman, because it is also about the Red Heifer, because Dod, the Messiah and returning king, the second of the three Zeruah, turns out that Dod wants Israel back. And Israel, he is the groom that is coming out of his chamber upon his return, and he wants Israel back. And so for him to take Israel back, she has to be shown not guilty by a specific test that's presented in Numbers 5. It's one of those things that no one understands the prophecy of the Red Heifer until now. No one understood that whole exchange of the adulterous woman because no one's ever been subject to it. We're going to explain specifically how all of those things fit together and how Yisrael becomes cleansed again and can, if you will, the whore takes the bath. I'm providing the cleansing material for the whore so that Dod can be back in a covenant relationship with Yisrael. It's actually, we're laughing at portions of it because, well, how do you not laugh at your own funeral? But it is actually, it is a marvelous story. And there are so many hilarious and gut-wrenching episodes to it, and there's so many places it's discussed. We even have to fully understand it. We have to go back to the time that Aaron and his sons, how Aaron's sons were killed because they approached the Ark of the Covenant without being properly prepared, and they had been religious, and they were disgusting, and Yahweh says, no, I'm not, you can't come into my presence like that. This is what happens to you. Why if the Red Heifer doesn't offer to cleanse and reconcile Yisrael, then when Yahweh returns, every remaining Yisraelite, the remnant of Israel, would be instantly incinerated and die. So literally, he is offering his life to prepare Israel for Yahweh's return. And that is the very same thing that Yahweh told Moshe. And he said, yeah, you need to inform Aaron that if he were to try the same trick, because he's also stained by religion, that he too will die. So this is the remedy, and the remedy is bull's blood. And so as the bull, I am the one who has to shed my blood to prepare the priest to be able to come back and to anoint the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant so that Yisrael can be reconciled with God and endure his return. This is quite a story, and it has many, many layers to it. And so, since it is maybe the most essential story, prophetically, in the Torah, the most expensive story in the Torah and Prophets, by far, is Dod's fulfillment of Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim, which most people don't know, that the Messiah and Son of God, the former and returning king of Israel, it was the Passover lamb. But from a prophetic point of view, there is more references to the role that I have been asked to play in preparing Israel for, and Goyim, really, for these two harvests, the Shavuot harvest and the Teruah harvest, and then to perform as the Adamah Perah on the morning of Teruah, to resolve the guilt, the remaining religious guilt of Israel, so that Yahweh can return without killing his people. It is interwoven throughout the Torah and Prophets. So we want to tell the story, since it is so essential to Israel's salvation and reconciliation as completely as possible, so there are no questions remaining. So I'm going to be trying to and summarize some of what we talked about a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
A prophetic pronouncement and timely declaration regarding the removal of the tremendous burden of Damascus. Behold, Damascus is revolting, God says, and corrupt, degenerate, and unrestrained, and will be removed from inhabited cities. It will actually become a twisted and tangled heap of collapsed structures, fallen buildings, and rubble. Yeshayah 17:1. Read like tomorrow's newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can look at it as someone might have 5 years ago, you would say that you were witnessing the fulfillment of it, because with the Syrian civil war, Damascus was, in fact, you can look at the aerial and drone footage of it even now, it looks like Gaza. It is a tumbled ruin. But that is not actually the fulfillment of the prophecy. The fulfillment of the prophecy, will go on and find out that it's Israel that is responsible for turning Damascus into rubble. And they do so because Iran and the religious mullahs of Iran are going to have more and more trouble funneling the weapons of mass destruction into Lebanon. And so an easier place to stage them, with actually closer to Jerusalem and closer to Tel Aviv and the population centers, is in Damascus. And Damascus provides the same cover, civilians that are human shields for these weapons. And so Israel is going to recognize that we have a choice. Our choice is to die from them or to take them out. And they will take them out. And they, in the process, are going to turn Damascus into a heap of rubble. This is important to know, not only because God knows the future and we know and are prepared for what's going to occur, but that's the triggering event for what follows. So this continues. Abandoned and damned, destroyed and deserted, will be the inhabited and terrorized regions of anguished cities filled with disgusting religious temples and shrines, as well as wrathful donkeys of Aror, the repudiated outcasts and repugnant refugees of the Arnon Valley and Ammon, Jordan. This, of course, is speaking of the Palestinians, the Muslims who are called Palestinians for strictly deceptive reasons to create the illusion, and it's obviously prevailing, because if you were to ask 1,000 people, are there a people called Palestinians, a Palestinian people in a place called Palestine, they would answer in the affirmative, when both aren't even remotely accurate, and anybody with half a brain that has done 15 minutes worth of study would know they are both outright lies. And my view has always been, if you have to lie to make your point, you have no point.
Yes.
And so this is saying that the Palestinians, these Muslims in the pretend refugee camp, how the hell could be a refugee camp when they've been there forever and Jordan is the Palestinian state? If you want to pretend like there's a Palestinian. But nonetheless, that's what they call them, and God is saying they're nothing but repugnant donkeys. For there will be roaming animals fighting in militant militias along with their helpers. They call them Ansar in the Quran and Islam. But they will cease and prostrate themselves, the signature move of Islam, because there will be no one left to terrorize. Yeah, the fact of the matter is that Muslims murder more Muslims than they do infidels. And so they will turn on themselves, and that's part of the Sunni-Shia rivalry. But even when there's no Sunni and Shia rivalry, Islamic terrorist gangs do what they are doing, for example, in Libya. And they have done it now in Syria and Iraq for decades. That was Yeshayah 17:2. Isaiah 17:3 reads, so the fortified city and defensive structures will cease to exist. As a result of Ephraim, as a result of Israel. So Israel is going to be responsible for doing this, and it's for Israel, it's do or die. Along with the government out of Damascus, including the residue left of Aram, Syria, including some of the military influence over Iran, Iraq, and Jordan, Arman, for being similarly vehement and burdensome, fanatical, and of course, dim-witted. Taken back to the picture of Yahya Sinwar with a hole in his head and no brain. The children, you know, it might sound like I'm gloating, yet when a disgusting piece of shit like that gets exterminated, it is good news for the world. This is a man that inspired pure evil, and then he brought hell on his own people. The children of Yisrael, individuals who engage and endure with God, will actually continue to exist. Prophetically declares Yahweh, the vast array of spiritual messengers among us. And we're going to find out how they will continue to exist against this backdrop that is so dire of and world war right on and surrounding Israel.
Mm-hmm.
However, it will truly transpire in that day that the size of Jacob, which is Israel, will be decreased to the point of no longer being sustainable or viable. The fattest, best protected, and most important place at the midsection of his physical existence will be leaned and wastefully sacrificed as part of the sickening agenda of world leaders, Isaiah 17:4. There is probably no more stupid idea in the long list of stupid ideas than the two-state solution. It is, in fact, it's an oxymoron to say two states and solution in the same breath. It is playing Neville Chamberlain, but in a far worse scenario. Neville Chamberlain gave the high ground of Czechoslovakia, which wasn't his to give, to the Nazis to achieve peace in our time. And, of course, it led to the worst world war and global history. And it was certain to do so. The moment you appease those who are ruthless, you will get an outbreak of ruthlessness. In a particular case, you're giving a religious group of people who have emerged out of a death cult, whose most defining moment is the Pledge of Aqaba, which is to wage war against all mankind, who have perpetrated genocide against Jews for 1,400 years, who have far more land than sense, whose religion is based on lying. In fact, the whole concept of Hudabaya is that Muslims are not bound by any agreement, and they have continued to show that their favorite signature move is to be terrorists. If you're going to give these people territory carved out of the heart of Israel so as to satiate them under this guise that these fanatical terrorists deserve to have their own state, and of course what they'll do is just use it to annihilate Israel. There was quite a spat this week from another man that must have dental floss for brains, Macron of France, telling Netanyahu that he ought not speak against the United Nations when the United Nations is responsible for founding Israel. And Netanyahu had the first, had part of his response correct, but not the whole response correct. The answer is, you blankety-blank idiot. The state of Israel was founded by God.
Yeah.
Perhaps you heard of it. Not only was the state of Israel founded by God and given to the Jewish people, but even when the United Nations, out of the total embarrassment of what Europeans, including the French, did to the Jewish people during the Holocaust, that even after all of that, our homeland is acknowledged again after killing 6 million of us in Europe. All of the Muslims around us reneged on that agreement. Said, no, they can't have a state. No, even with Gaza being part of Egypt, even with the West Bank being part of Jordan, that little territory in between. No, they can't have that. The Muslims turned on it and tried to exterminate them. They reneged on the agreement. And so is the blood of Jews, some Holocaust survivors, that reestablished the Jewish state. What in the hell are you talking about, Macron? Are you that stupid? The idiocy of the world today. Sacrifice as part of the sickening agenda of world leaders. Then, now this is interesting, because what it's saying is that Damascus is going to be turned into a heap of rubble. The two-state solution is going to be forced on Israel from outside the country. And then, at that time, there will exist something which can be compared to the collecting and bringing together of an intensely dramatic ingathering, the removal and receiving, asaph, of a harvest, cutting away and reaping during a short but vexing time, katsir, of standing grain, deeply rooted, steadfast, upright, and established, kamah. And his Zeroa, the one who is cultivating the seed sown for this harvest to be fruitful and productive, will reap the harvest with unfolding implications, cutting the valued crop away during his troubling time of first fruit, forming an overflowing torrent moving swiftly from one place to another in linear fashion as a result of this stem off the main branch. Which is to say, the Teruah, this marvelous Moed Mikre, the next to be fulfilled after Jod, the Messiah, the Son of God, fulfilled Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim, the harvest that follows it is Shavuah. It is a harvest of standing grain. It will be fulfilled next. And it will be fulfilled concurrent with this destruction of Damascus, the fall of the Syrian government, and the establishment of a Muslim state of terror carved out of the heart of Israel, thinning the nation to approximately 5 miles in width, where some 70 to 80% of the people reside, becoming utterly defenseless.
Mm-hmm.
This is a series of events. Now, this brings us, that alone should have been among the most amazing prophecies ever written. And mind you, this prophecy was not only written 2,700 years ago, 27 centuries ago. It was memorialized on the great Isaiah scroll that dates to around 300 BCE, so that it itself is 2,300 years old. The written text of this prophecy. When God gives prophecy, man, he's good at it. This is such an example. So this brings us to the next installment, which is even more amazing than the previous one, particularly if you want to know what's going to happen. Now, my strong advice is don't rely on this. What follows tells you what is going to happen to me. It tells you what's going to happen to the remnant of Yisrael. It is gut-wrenching. But you can miss all of this and get the ride of a lifetime by being among those who are harvested during Shavuah. If you want to know when all this is going to happen, Shavuah is 7 years before Yahweh's return. It is May 22nd, 2026, a Shabbat, of course, when God does his best work. And he will remain, speaking of the Zeruah, the one who cultivates his harvest, I am the third Zeruah, and he will remain, enduring being left behind as flesh and blood. For having caused people with physical bodies to be spared as a remnant. Wa-sa'ar. Then acting as kin in a close relationship, speaking of the Zeruah, he will stay behind, his body serving as a reminder for the remainder of the extended family who are still leavened a remnant of blood relatives left over, and the remaining is physical being. It's written identically to Sha'or, leaven, Sha'ar, remnant, remainder, and residue, and Sha'ir, physical body comprised of flesh and blood, a corporeal mass of meat. It was written in the Nifl perfect, third person masculine singular, where the subject, who is the Zeruah, who has been cultivating the fruitful harvest and productive gleaning, will carry out and endure the action which is to be left behind while causing others to remain in physical bodies based on the choices that he has made. Mahu during it. So, this remnant is going to be specifically left behind during the Teruah Lakat. Thrust aside and left behind on the stems and branches, as would be the case when an olive tree is beaten from all around to shake off some of the fruit, mature olives in the top most crucial and foremost, even vocal branch, who speaks, who promises, and who relates, four or five in the clefts of his crag from his branches which have been broken off. The top uttermost branches would be Yehuda. Those branches which would be broken off would be Yisrael, of the fruitful and productive heifer, of the one cultivating and flourishing, producing an abundant harvest on behalf of future generations, prophetically declares Yahweh of Yisrael. So this final action of determining how some seven, which would be two or three plus four or five, uppermost branches, those branches which have been cut off, are to remain in physical bodies, is being perpetrated now by the Zeruah, one cultivating this productive harvest, as a heifer, a fruitful and productive heifer. So says Yahweh through Yeshayah. This was spoken by Yahweh himself, the God of Israel. So, you certainly notice that Shavua is a cascade harvest. It's followed by Teruah, which is a lakat, gleaning 7 years later. The promise of sevens will materialize at the outset of the time of Yisrael's troubles, with the shimmering stream of souls leaving an anguished planet for a joyous experience in Shamayim on the Shabbat of May 22nd, 2026, 7 years before those return with Yahweh. Then the Ha'et Sar, Yaakov, comes to a frantic and horrific close as a consequence of the adversary's manipulation. And as that occurs, the final few will be withdrawn on trumpets, a Friday, of course, a Shabbat evening at sunset, September 23rd, 2033, with yet another stream of light headed out of harm's way. On this day, however, as part of Teruah, there will be an Olaha caused by the choder, the stem that's whacking away at the olive tree. In addition to the olives which are gleaned, there will be seven olives thrust aside and left on the branches. Seven is either a multiple of 100, 700, or 1,000, 7,000, 10,000, could be 70,000, could even be 700,000 is a multiple of this. And I will do the math to tell you how that number can be calculated. Well, they will not be part of the Lakat. And it was always a question as to, then this resolves it, which is, we have a Shavuah harvest, which is of standing grain. Yahweh says it's of different varieties of wheat, and therefore represents as the same thing that the two loaves of bread represent. It represents the harvest of both mature Goyim and Yisraelim, a Yehudim. And that's followed 7 years later by this Teruah harvest. It is obviously an olive harvest. That would mean Israelites and Yehudim. That is gleaned here at the last moment. But with them both gone, and Yahweh talking about his family reunion and homecoming, and the people, living people, physical people, looking up as father and son return, and crying at that point as they would for a firstborn, which represents those. You have to have mortals on the earth in Jerusalem who are prepared and waiting for Yahweh's return on this day, October 2nd, 622 is the sunset in Jerusalem. This is October 2nd, 2033. He was 6,000 Yah. And so with these two harvests, the first harvest, Shavuah, capturing and gleaning, returning to heaven, everyone who has become a member of the covenant between the time that we really began this and Yahweh's name was reintroduced to his people, and the covenant terms and conditions were discussed, and the Moed Mikre were explained, and God's role in fulfilling it was articulated, positioning people to capitalize on the Shavuah harvest, they all leave at the onset of the time of Yosef's trouble. Then 7 years later, we have this final gleaning on Teruah. Now that only leaves 10 days. How in the world are we going to have a homecoming, you're wondering, in 10 days? You know, it's been 7 years where on the last three and a half of that, Elia, the most articulate of God's prophets, and I, who is fairly, verbose, if nothing else, that's what some would say. But I'm not the most inarticulate guy either. And we have 3.5 years with signs being produced above our heads where we are essentially immortal. Everyone in the world will be trying to kill us. And yet, there we are on the Temple Mount with Yahweh producing copious signs above us, including these books of the Yada Yada series and showing them. And after all of that, we finally get to Teruah 10 days before Yahweh's return, and there's another gleaning. So where are you going to get the people for the homecoming? You only got 10 days left.
Right.
Well, Yahweh had a brilliant answer, and he articulated this answer back at the time the Torah was being revealed. The answer is the Adama Torah, the red heifer, which is why Yeshayah introduced us to how the final Teruah, the Choder, the Adah, will be serving as this heifer. Because what's going to happen is he's going to offer his life. And Yahweh is going to create this marvelous spring under the Temple Mount. He's going to ignite this fire, and Eliyah is going to orchestrate the occasion. He's going to have all the proper ingredients there, and the ashes mixed with water will flow off the Temple Mount into Jerusalem, around the inhabitants, and it will clean the city, and prepare the inhabitants of Jerusalem for Yahweh's return. It's the Great Reset.
Mm-hmm.
Jews go back to the same exact situation they were in when around Mount Horeb, Yahweh arranged to speak directly to them. Yahweh said to Moshe, I'm going to give you 3 days, clean up the people, get their attire cleaned. I want them clean. And then I'm going to come off of this mountain. I'm going to endure them. Yet I know they still sink to high heaven and are still filled with religiosity and they are disgusting. But I owe it to you. I owe it to everyone that's going to read this Torah to demonstrate that I, God, Yahweh, am revealing it to you. So I'm going to come off this mountain. I'm going to speak directly to them once you've cleaned them up for the occasion. We're returning them to that state. The Great Reset. Because what happened 3,000, almost 500 years ago is the children of Israel told God to go away. We don't ever want to see you or hear from you again. The worst decision in the history of humanity. And they've done nothing to change their mind. This prepares them for Yahweh's return. That is the story of the Red Heifer. Therefore, on this day, as part of Teruah, there is a group that is only that is left behind. They are olives that are still on either the branches, the top branches representing Yehudim, because Yahud was the uppermost from Yah's point of view, or those who were cut away, as the Assyrians took Yisrael, the northern kingdom, off into slavery. Between the two, there will be a multiple of seven. They are not part of the Lakot. And since this was prefaced by Sha'ar, we know that they will remain in physical bodies while the Zeruah will be reduced to flesh and blood. As the sun rises and the full light of Teruah is manifest, that same day from the Hebrew perspective, sound the shofar. Because the Zeruah is going to become the Perah. Now also interesting, as they play on words, Yahshua affirmed the obvious, that Toter is, he used a mirror for both. I shared that with you the last week. He also said that there was a crag with cracks and crevices to show that this crag has grown older. He has the battle scars that he has earned along the way, and that collectively he is going to reach out to and protect those who are left behind. Now, as we studied last week, and I'm going to redo some of this, and some of it will be new to our listeners, Par-Bol is written as Pe-Rosh in Hebrew. Pe-Rosh means a mouth of an observant person. Pe is still mouth in Hebrew. Rosh is drawn as a head, as a person with ears and eyes and a mouth and a head. So somebody who sees, who hears, who thinks, and then speaks. And so Pe-Rosh, which are among the final six letters in the Hebrew alphabet, which is important because it's the end of mankind's rule of the earth as we have seen him, is a man who is known for having a really big head and a really, really big mouth. The Par listens, observes, thinks, and then speaks. This is why Yahweh is called the whole voice of God. It is also significant to reveal that Parah, the fruitful one, is scribed Pe-Rosh He. Now that's represented in the original letters that presented the Torah as a mouth, as an observant individual, and then as a person standing up, reaching up, and looking up to God as a hay. This affirms that the heifer, the parah, is human. All three of the letters that comprise the word parah depict human features. A mouth, a human head, and a man standing up, looking up, and reaching up to God. The heifer is human, just as was the Passover lamb. He was goat, just as will be the man officiating these ceremonies, because Eliyah is the goat. The productive and fruitful bull pursuing the harvest is therefore an exceptionally vocal, observant, and thoughtful man who takes a stand to point the way to God. In his final stand in this role, he is dubbed, therefore, the Parah, the Adamah Parah, the man who is the heifer. Now, as is the case with almost every word sharing the par root of bull, Parah, which we will confront as we make our way through the Torah from Bamidbar 19 to Numbers 5, from the red heifer to the adulterous woman, is defined as to expose and to dismiss, to uncover and then absolve. In this context, the red heifer is ensuing sacrifice on Teruah on behalf of those left behind. It is to unbind and discharge with payment remitted to overlook the penalty. One life given for many. Foreshadowing what the heifer will endure as we consider his ordeal in the fourth book of the Torah, Parah speaks of bearing the skin and smashing away at it to provide compensation. Describing the nature of those bludgeoning the heifer to death, Parah reveals that an unrestrained mob will be out of control as they slaughter the heifer. The related parits and parek speak of the Choder's adversary, Hasatan, that is the savage and cruel creature who is a violent and ravenous beast devoted to the death and destruction of not only Yada, but of anyone who speaks for Yahweh, doing so in the most ruthless and barbaric, brutal manner. He is a rapacious and ferocious robber. Of Satan's minion, Perah says that they are a brood of brats and swarming rabble, chaotic and violent youths. Then, addressing Perah's positive traits, Parah is used to describe a shoot or a stem, spare fruit, and a leader, who provides freedom. In this regard, the related Pari depicts a fruitful harvest producing young offspring. This may be why Parah is defined as a bud which blossoms, addressing that which will happen to the Zeruah's soul in the waning hours of Teruah. It will be a Parah, able to fly away, making a linear motion through the air, flying off to Shamaim as his body is incinerated along with Yisrael's guilt. Parah means to release, to let loose, to let go, to cast off, and to run free and wild, totally emancipated. So in this context, it would be reminiscent of let my people go. It speaks of the initiation of another Yasa harvest. And in this context, it's, of course, interesting to be aware that Perah is a prince who governs, and he is a fighter who defends. When spelled with an aleph rather than the own, Parah means to thrive and fruitfulness. Now, while the tertiary definition of Parah is deduced from the feminine ah suffix to par, bull, the actual meaning of the word is to be very productive and fruitful, cultivating offspring through an abundant harvest. Therefore, to be Parah is to be the Zeruah. To be Parah is to cause others to sprout, blossom, and flourish, to thrive, promoting their growth and their maturity. Yasaya's treatise on proper chodery and how to recognize and respond to the Zeruah by introducing Parah, productive heifer, leads us to what is perhaps the most challenging of all prophetic declarations to process. It says, in essence, that Yada, the Zeruah, is going to allow Satan to slaughter him, so that when the surviving remnant of Yisrael responds as instructed, they will live, properly prepared to witness and celebrate Kippurim, which is when Yahweh and Dod return. Now, the means to this end is the Adam of Parah, the red heifer. And in this regard, the first time a red heifer was recognized in Israel was when I was there. Since it is important to understand the context of all of this. And look forward from the time that Moshe shared the prophecy of the red heifer. Now, 1,000 years later, when Malachi, as the last of the prophets, revealed more information about this day, we find that he actually set the stage for what would occur. In the final words inspired by Yahweh to Yisrael, Malachi wrote about what would transpire on Teruah. It is Israel's final opportunity to come clean, and it is the earth's last chance. This is the final chapter of the final prophetic book inspired by God. Please pay especially close attention, because the day will vividly and actually arrive that a fiery light will burn, a blazing and consuming light that will combust and devour a burnt offering to purge and remove that which is senseless and stupid, like the flaming oven, a fire pot, and a furnace for an exceptionally intense blaze, like a crucible. Malachi, my messenger, Malachi, 4:1. As we will behold in the Torah's prophecy of the red heifer, the Ba'ar, fiery burnt, or fiery light burning to consume and remove that which is senseless and stupid, will be one that Eliyah asked Yahweh to ignite around the bludgeoned body of the Adama Perah. It will incinerate and eliminate the foolish idiocy that has rendered so many Jews recalcitrant and stubborn over the ages. And it will also serve as a beacon to awaken the surviving remnant of God's people so that they can come home, so they can participate in the family reunion and homecoming. Yahweh is very clear, especially when we consider his closing statement. This is more than a life or death event for Jews in Jerusalem, who will be excluded from the Teruah gleaning because they are going to be too religious and too political to say Yahweh's name, to accept the conditions of the covenant. If not for this fire purging the guilt and cleansing souls, Yahweh's very arrival would destroy them and the planet rather than enable them to return and celebrate a homecoming. Therefore, this is the last chance to come clean. Yada Ezra Zeruah, after, according to God, successfully orchestrating the Teruah gleaning during the evening of trumpets on September 23rd, 2033, is going to let his guard down. At sunrise on the 24th, he's going to allow the adversary to kill him. This will be like those celebrating Pesach as a meal in the evening after sunset and the following day, serving as the lamb. When, pursuant to God's instructions, Eliyah will arrange the bloodied body of the red heifer and the cedar according to the Torah specifications, and God's going to douse the scene, which will transpire on the Temple Mount for all to see, with a proliferation of water, which will emerge from a spring, which will erupt for the occasion. This will replicate, albeit on a much grander scale, what Eliyah orchestrated by burning the bull before Ahab, Jezebel, and the prophets of Baal, the Lord, and Asherah, the queen of heaven and the mother of God, to millennia, 888 years prior to this day. It will claim Moriah, Zion, and the city of Dod as the ashen waters pour off the mount. As before, this blazing spectacle will be ignited by God. So those idiots out there looking for a red cow that they can go kill so that Israel can be all better again. Forget it. If this isn't done according to God's schedule, to the person he has selected to carry it out and orchestrated by his prophet Elia on the Temple Mount, it will make no difference. Well, this is going to serve as a beacon to garner the remnant's attention and to call his people home. All the while, this blazing cauldron of bowl, of cedar, of hyssop, of ash, of steam and water, it's going to incinerate the religious and political guilt of the remnant of Israel, cleansing them sufficiently such that these mortals are prepared to reunite with Yahweh after a 3,480-year intermission for bad behavior. That is a very long time out.
Yes, sir.
So that is why this event is so important, that God talks about it from virtually every possible vantage point. Now, simultaneously, the trash in and around Jerusalem will be incinerated. Even the corporeal manifestation of Satan will be sent. Consider it cleaning house before the rightful owners arrive. Now, as we shall see, the reason that these were the last words inspired by God and shared with humankind is that the fire, the bowl, and ashes burning and purging the stubborn idiocy of Israelites is the last chance anyone will ever have to prepare themselves to enter God's presence. What Elia will accomplish with the red heifer on Teruah saves the earth from annihilation. Working together, we will succeed, or everything is for naught. The entire human experience. That might sound like hyperbole. That might sound like exaggeration. It isn't.
Mm-hmm.
God himself will conclude his final prophetic inspiration to humankind saying exactly that. If Elia and I fail to carry out this last opportunity to prepare Israel for Yahweh's return, consistent with Yahweh's instructions, God would just as soon annihilate the earth and the few people that are here at that time. That's what's at stake. So should you want to criticize this, be really careful, because that's the consequence. Now, according to what Yahweh inspired Malachi to write, a blaze engulfing the red heifer becomes a roaring conflagration, incinerating all who have come to claim Jerusalem, the source from which guidance and direction on reconciliation flow. This is a continuation of Malachi 4:1. Then, all of those who are presumptuous and arrogant, in addition to all who engage in and act upon that which is wickedly wrong so as to bear their guilt and remain condemnable, will become worthless stubble and wasteful chaff. And it will be scorched and set ablaze, burning them up and consuming them. This is do or die, folks.
Mm-hmm.
God's returning the entire earth to the conditions experienced at Eden, and religious trash does not belong. It's going to be incinerated. The great blaze consuming the red heifer, and at the same time, Israel's guilt, will also scorch the religious and political who are opposed to God and his people. The city of Dode and the mountain of God, Mount Moriah, will be expunged of all belligerents. Now, this is the first step in restoring Gan Eden. This next pronouncement can be read in two ways, both of which will transpire. The Choder, Sucker, and Stem, now more completely depicted as a Suresh and Anaf, will hold the religious and political accountable, seeing to it that they are burned. And by doing so, he will demonstrate his love for the remnant he will not forsake. As the Suresh and Anaf, He will return for those left behind. It reads, "This day which is coming, says Yahweh of the heavenly hosts, for there to be joy in this relationship, the steadfast Zeresh sucker emerging from the original root of the family line, and enough stem branching out from the trunk to provide cover, will not free or release them, nor will he abandon or forsake those left behind." This is the conclusion of Malachi 4:1. This isn't the day of days, but it is the dramatic prelude to Yom Kippur, Yahweh's and Do's homecoming. It makes the family reunion possible. It is important that we appreciate exactly what's transpiring here. The sacrifice of the red heifer, like that of the Passover lamb 40 Yobel previous to this day, would be nothing more than a gruesome murder of a willing victim without Yahweh's input and involvement. The lamb and the heifer, says Dod and Yada, are fulfilling the roles Yahweh has appointed for them. He and I were conceived and prepared for this purpose. So God is correct. For heaven to be heavenly, the hellish behavior experienced on earth must go. Therefore, he is eradicating the source of man's troubles. Religion, politics, and human militancy. Well, the Torah speaks specifically of this day and of the role that I have been asked to play, the primary responsibility for introducing and educating the choder who becomes the heifer has always fallen to Yahshayah. He reveals the nature of the man and details the support he will receive from God to compose the book the Almighty will use to garner Yisrael's attention and before it is too late. The great prophet Yahshayah and carrying it out and Yahshayah speaking to us about it presents the choder in his 11th chapter. He is presented as a sucker from the fallen stump and the neglected roots of Yisrael. He is also called a secondary stem off the main branch of the tree of lives while serving as the tree of knowledge. Zeresh sucker emerging from the rootstock and the family line and a mass stem branching out of the tree to provide a cover and to clarify all exist, communicate to God's people what is important for them to know on this day. Now, God is speaking of how the choder will morph into the Adam of Parah, a bloody man who has been fruitful and productive, indicating that the red heifer is going to appear at dawn on Teruah. Now, following the successful akat gleaning the previous sunset, which is the same day, of course, from the Hebrew perspective, the Zeruah, the one cultivating the harvest, will be transformed to save Yehudim, to save Yisrael and the planet. The same day concept is memorialized every week in the Shabbat. The Shabbat begins as we are celebrating it now, Friday at sunset.
Mm-hmm.
And it continues all day on Saturday until sunset. Teruah plays out the same way. And of course, God does his best work on the Shabbat, which is why Teruah takes place on the Shabbat. So then, she will appear at dawn, speaking of the red heifer. She will appear at dawn with the sunrise, shining brightly, ascending with the sun for the dawning of a new day, providing enlightenment on your behalf and for all of you to approach, who respect and value my name, the rightful and vindicating son of righteousness, along with the restoration and reconciliation, providing a remedy for mortal man, curing them of the plague, within her extremities, exposed epidermis, in the outermost part of her appearance, as she takes flight to the cornerstone, Ba'Kanaf. You should come forth during this time of Exodus, leaping and frolicking like young bulls who have come full circle back to where it all began, Egel, as maturing bovines. Now this is spelled identically to Agol, which is to establish a pattern which has been repeated and can be played out over again, contemplating being able to stretch out in a restful dwelling place again. Malachi, my messenger, Malachi 4:2. So many marvelous insights in this final pronouncement pursuant to what the Choder and Zeruah are going to accomplish with Eliyah immediately before Yahweh's return. It's hard to even know where to start. Since the subject is she, the reference is to Yahweh's role as the red heifer, or as the Zeruah, which is also a feminine noun. As was the case with Doe during Passover, the celebration will commence after sunset, while the sacrifice will occur following the sunrise. The Hebrew day was arranged this way to accommodate the schedule of unfolding events on Pesach and now on Teruah. And it is this sacrifice and what Eliyah reveals about it will add days to the lives of the remnant of Yisrael, enlightening them at this time. And this is necessary so that they can be seen in Yahweh's presence. Now, even though the heifer's sacrifice for the benefit of all who remain occurs, it only serves those who respect Yahweh's name. This is an essential insight that is lost on the vast preponderance of Israelites. It is why from the very beginning, starting 32 years prior to this selfless act, that the primary mission of Yada Yahwa has been to Yada Yahwa. In the prophetic portrayal of the Adam of Hurrah in the Torah, Yahweh specifically stated that the red heifer would be both perfect and correct, and thus tzedakah, right and vindicating. And by burning the sacrifice, skin and all, the remnant's guilt is incinerated, which caused this event to be reconciling. Yisrael is restored, cleansing their garments and souls such that they can witness Yahweh's return. Now, while Dod is represented by the sun in God's skin, he is specifically called the as brilliant as the sun and God's presence. Yad is not the sun. He is the moon, reflecting the Messiah's light. The heifer mirrors Dod's sacrifice, preparing the way for the king's return. Therefore, at this minute, he is sharing the spotlight, which is appropriate considering the magnitude of the moment.
Mm-hmm.
This is largely because had Yada not reestablished Doe's credentials and then subjected himself to this, there would be no one for the Son of God to meet on this day.
Mm-hmm.
The remaining Israelites would still be wallowing in their religious and political filth, unaware of their king's role in their salvation. That is not hyperbole. That is not an exaggeration. Israel had gone 3,000 years without the recognition that Dod served as the Pesach Ael, that Dod is the Messiah, that he is the Son of God, that he is the King who is returning. And what was going to change after 3,000 years of denial? If not for this role, but Yahweh has not just asked me to play, but has enabled me to do this job on behalf of his people. Nevertheless, in this way, and at moment, Yada will have become essentially the Prince of Reconciliation, preparing Israel for the arrival of their God and their King. And while appropriate for this occurrence, it's my conclusion that this is a somewhat different solution to the one that Job provided during Pesach and Masa, leading to Bukhudom. Those who embrace his bereft and attend the Mohadim he fulfilled, aware of what he has done, become immortal, eternally perfected, enriched and empowered children of the covenant. These individuals are given a lifetime to explore the Torah, the prophets, and respond appropriately. As a result, they are long gone, having enjoyed the Shavua Ketzir. However, in this case, with only 10 days remaining between Teruah and Kippurim, and with the entire remnant way too religious and political to have been part of that final Lakot gleaning, there just isn't enough time for them to make an informed decision. Therefore, what Yahweh is doing is turning back the clock. He is reenacting that day when more than 3 millennia ago, when he last spoke to them, and he told them, and they told him, to go away. On this day, the descendants of those people will have the opportunity to respond more appropriately and to give them that chance, that choice. My sacrifice with the fire, the ashes, the blood, and the water will be cleaning them up sufficiently to survive Yahweh's presence. My role is simply to make the homecoming possible during what will be the final Exodus. And that is why Yahweh has returned to the Egel, telling all who would listen that we are coming back full circle to where it all began long ago. That is what Egel means. The Egel, now a parah, heifer both ways, is reprising his role in the formation, now the reconciliation, of the covenant relationship. And should you be unaware of how an Egel, an Ix, and an Eel were present, making their contribution to the first feast of the covenant, we're going to turn to that presentation as well. It is so amazingly insightful. Now, Kanaf is a curious term. I've shared this before, but it is typically translated as wing. But neither the heifer, the choder, nor son have them. Its verbal root is Kanaf. It's spelled the same way, but it says nothing of winged flight. The actual root is to be thrust to side, which would address what the Zeroah did to the mortal remnant of Yisrael after gleaning the olive tree. And it sometimes is rendered to be hidden from view, which is what will happen to the religious leaven. The red heifer's blood and ash will remove, and the fire incinerates. Now, in the noun variation, in addition to a wing, kanaf is presented at times as extremity, edge, border, corner, or skirt. All connotations derive from the context. So, digging deeper, kana is to be given a flattering title or surname, a cognomen or epithet. Also, can addresses that which is right, just, honest, true, verifiable, and correct. Therefore, knowing the story of the red heifer that we're going to analyze as we make our way through this series and this material, since Yahweh makes such a big issue of burning the remains, skin and all, there's something about Parah's hide that is perceived as healing and restorative. And in this regard, we're told that Yada will be beaten to death, and his skin will be covered in the blood, which is curative. and brings life. Now, the parbull's role, whether presented as an egel or a parar, is to stamp out toxic vipers and serpents, devilish men and demonic spirits. And therefore, in the wake of the heifer sacrifice, the children to join in, stamping out evil wherever it is found. And this is how it is presented by Yahweh in his last revelation to humankind. Malachi 4:3. Then you will tread upon and trample down the religious who are wicked and wrong, guilty and condemnable. Because branded with a stigma, they have chosen to be ashes under the soles of your feet and hooves. During the day, which for the benefit of the relationship, I'm going to engage and act, says Yahweh, the assembled spiritual envoys. So we're reminded that the purpose of this day is to stamp out religious corruption, removing its stain and stigma from the presence of the people. And our attention is brought back to the role of the red heifer, with the cremated ashes purging the guilt of those who would otherwise be seen as worthless. Also, while all of this has been in Yahweh's voice, God is telling his people that he will re-engage in their lives in this way and on this day. Once again, Yahweh's sacrifice would mean nothing, however, apart from what Yahweh does with it. This is why God turns our attention to the Torah. It is in the Torah that the prophecy of the red heifer is presented. And this is where we learn the purpose of Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim as they enable Shavuot and then Teruah. And they, in turn, make Purim possible so that we might enjoy Sukkah. It is also where we come to know Yahweh by name, appreciate what he is offering, and understand what he is asking in return. This is Malachi 4:4. Remember Moshe's, my associate's Torah, which to lead to the benefits of the relationship and along the path to get the greatest joy out of life, I instructed and directed through him upon Torah, the cutting edge and dividing line, on behalf of all Yisrael. Even the inscribed prescriptions which cut you into the relationship and the means to exercise good judgment regarding disputes. Yahweh likes working with us. That's why he mentions Moshe's name. He partnered with Moshe in delivering his Torah teaching by allowing his colleague to interpret portions of it. In fact, all of Darbayin is Moshe's analysis and interpretation of the Torah. By doing so, God not only becomes deniable and resistible by design, we get to witness how others have responded to him over time. It's an absolute genius approach. God wants to be deniable. He wants to be resistible. He wants to give us the opportunity to choose to be with him or to ignore him. Also, by concluding his message to mankind, referencing the Torah of Moshe, Yahweh is announcing that his guidance and instructions matter, while the rabbinical Talmud is worthless. God wants us properly informed and then free to exercise good judgment regarding what he has shared with us. And of course, on the day the heifer of Teruah brings the children of Yisrael back to Choreb, where the descendants who heard and rejected Yahweh's voice have the opportunity to make a better choice. Not only is the brilliantly sarcastic Elia joining the loquacious Yada as one of the two witnesses heralding those return with Yahweh, he will be orchestrating the events pursuant to the sacrifice of the red heifer. He is not only the perfect choice, he's the lone individual who has practiced in this regard. In fact, the best way to appreciate what Yahweh is seeking to accomplish with his Adam HaParah is to discover what Eliyah did two millennia, 888 years ago. And in this series, we are going to detail that. And it is a treat, I'll tell you, for the ears. You will enjoy every moment of it, as it all serves as a harbinger of what is to come. Look, God says, I will send out on your behalf Elijah the prophet to come before the great and awesome, awe-inspiring day of Yahweh. Malachi 4:5. When Elijah returns, Yahweh's return is near. The great awe-inspiring day of Yahweh is Yom Kippurim, the day of reconciliations in year 6000 Yah. That is sunset, October 2nd, 2033. Every word we will share will serve this purpose. And he will promote change to turn around, restore, and return. The thinking and judgment, the motivations and inclinations of the parents over and regarding their sons, thinking and judgment and attitude, and the sons to their progenitors. Lest I come and strike the earth as a curse, as a gift, which has been disfigured and mutilated and destroyed. Malachi, my messenger, 4:6. Powerful.
Yeah.
Now, we're going to play your song here in just a moment. We've reached the conclusion of Malachi, and it's the perfect introduction for what is going to happen on this day. And I'd like to finish my thoughts on it, and we will move from there to a brief recap of Malachi, and then to your song. So long ago,
okay.
Yahweh wrote that the religious failings of the fathers would haunt their children. The truth. What has occurred? Three millennia, God wants that to change. He wants parents to properly instruct their children and for their children to recognize their Heavenly Father and their spiritual mother so that we can all be part of the covenant family. The reason that the events of Teruah, Friday evening and Saturday, September 23rd and 24th, 2033, mean so much to God is that this day and these events dominate his final revelation to his people. And that is because without it, the earth remains disfigured and accursed, polluted by religious and political rubbish. The red heifer is going to cure all of that, enabling the homecoming and the family reunion that God so desires with his people, making this day great indeed. Now with that, I'm going to play the Song of the Red Heifer. We can pick it up on the other side with the introduction to Numbers 19:2, and then we'll probably end this program and pick it up there again next week. And I know we went over some previous material, but as I've had the opportunity to invest the time to study all the related pieces that fit into this plan that Yahweh has articulated over the past 3,500 years, since it is the essence of how Israel resolves its religious and political guilt such that they can come clean with Yahweh. I can't think of anything that's more important to promote correctly. And so while I know we have gone over some of the existing turf and we have many, many more days to go down this path, deserves our undivided attention. It deserves the best effort we can devote to do it. This then is the song regarding the Adam of Hurrah. Last week we played my wife's song in this regard. These songs are available with video and with the lyrics on Rumble and YouTube, the Yada Yada channels on both. I will tell you that as beautiful as the songs are in terms of the instrumentation and the voice and the lyrics, they're 100 times more powerful when you get to see them on your computer screen, on your phone, or on your television, on YouTube, or on Rumble, Yada Yada channel.
A script had come to the house of Aaron, a ransom for his religious crime, a sacrifice upon the mountain, reconciliation comes at the end of time. Adam, a tired old red heifer, slaughtered like a kinsman before the heifer is slain. Adam, a part of the ashes red.
In just 10 days, the King of Shalom returns.
over your teeth.
According to God, they are the two men who will have sacrificed the most to restore the nation and lives of Yisrael. So now that we are better positioned to appreciate what was and what will be, I'd like to commence once again into the very prophecy of the Adam of Korah, the red heifer as we were led to it, by both the prophet Yeshayah, Isaiah, and by the prophet Malachi, both of whom were speaking for Yahweh. It begins, then Yahweh spoke to Moshe, the one who draws out, and to Aaron, the alternative, to say, this is a inscribed prescription for living, of the Torah, of the teaching and guidance, which to enjoy the benefits of the relationship is instructed and authoritatively directed because it is appointed and it is assigned by Yahweh, who spoke to affirm and promise to and tell Bnei Yisrael, the children who engage and endure with God, to choose and accept, to obtain and grasp hold of for yourselves the Adam of Korah, the bloody red man on the ground who is fruitful as a red heifer, moral and innocent, perfected, entirely right and truthful, who in showing the proper way, there is not in this any shame or guilt. As a result of the relationship, it has never taken up or carried on it a yoke as a means of controlling or of burdening. Bamidbar in the wilderness, Numbers 19, 1 and 2. This is just the beginning. And it is being conveyed to Moshe and to Aaron because, well, it's both part of Yahweh's written instructions to Yisrael, as were conveyed to Moshe, and specifically for those serving in the role of priest, in the case of Aaron, and anointing the approach to the covenant home and to the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant that is so central to what occurs on Yom Kippurim. It is a chukah, inscribed prescription for living. It pertains to those who are willing to read what they must do to live. This is part of Yahweh's Torah guidance and direction. Those who act upon it will asher, enjoy the benefits of the relationship. Specifically, Yahweh has not only appointed and assigned this responsibility to someone of his chosen, he is offering authoritative directions on how to benefit from what he intends. This Shawa instruction has pronounced and written, was pronounced on behalf of the children of Yisrael. It therefore applies to God's people. Yehudim are being encouraged and of their own free will to lachash, to accept, to obtain, to grasp hold of for themselves an Adam of Korah, a bloody man on the ground, been fruitful and productive, now designated as the red heifer. But what is that? Why was it described this way? Where would one find such a thing? What does one do with it? Well, as I've shared previously, Adam and Adama convey much more than ruddy or bloody red. Adam is the name of Yahweh's companion in the garden. It is used throughout the Torah and the Navi to convey man. As Adama, it also means dirt, earth, and ground. And so Adama is a bloody red man on the ground. Also revealing the primary meaning of Parah is to be fruitful, which is the role of the Zeroah, who is cultivating the Sabuah Kassir and the Teruah Lakot, the harvest and the gleaning, to take place on the fourth and fifth Mikre. The book ends for the time of Jacob's troubles. In the Yeshaya prophecy, the master instructor on totering concluded with Parah, specifically to address the fruitful proclivity of the Zeroah, pursuant to these harvests. It was his remark, of course, that led us to contemplating the example of the red heifer and the role that the Zeroah would play in sacrificing his life in this way. Therefore, since Zeroah's contribution to the Kassir is the reason that Par Bull is sacrificed on Shavuah, and is used to anoint the mercy seat during Kippurim, the Mikre before and after Teruah, Parah speaks of a fruitful and productive bull, a par, in nature and in the natural world of things. A parah is the heifer. So if you want a bull to be productive, you're going to describe that bull as a heifer. Therefore, most of all of these connotations that we have shared apply. Oh, well, Yada is clearly a man. Well, in his present body anyway. Parah, fruitful, like Zeroah, one cultivating the harvest, is feminine, as is Nefesh Bol, which is residing in and animating both the Zeroah and the Parah, the heifer. And following the sacrifice, it is the Nefesh which will be all that remains of this once very bold bull. Now in this case, since Adama Parah is now a bloody red man tossed on the ground, treated appropriately in accordance with the Torah, he will become the Parah, the heifer, giving Israel new life, which of course is a feminine role. Now while I recognize that we have already plumbed Par and Parah for insights, there is so much at stake. We just want to make certain that everyone understands that Par Rosh, which is bull, Par in Hebrew, these letters, which are again found in the last six in the Hebrew alphabet, mean that this bull will be a man who is known for his thinking and for his mouth, for being observant as a Nakar, the observant foreigner. Yahweh's Par listens, he observes, he thinks, he speaks. It is also important to know that in the feminine, Par as Parah, the fruitful one, was scribed with three human elements in the ancient script. A mouth, a head that is observant, and is a person who will stand up and point the way home to God. All of these insights take us to a closer understanding of why God chose this title. Now it is clearly an honor to be seen projecting these qualities. Parah is a very well-chosen moniker. Now, as we return to the text of this prophecy, according to the Torah, Adama Parah is Tamim, which means to say that he is a beneficiary of Pesach and Masa, and he has been perfected. All the while, he has been Tamim, moral, truthful, and right. In so doing, he has Asher shown the proper way to receive the benefits of the relationship. It's intriguing that Adama Parah, the red heifer, has never been yoked. As we talked last week, this means that he works and lives independently of human religious and political influences. And indeed he does. Something that I thought was magnificent in its subtlety is that Ol, which means that he is unyoked, shares the exact same root as Alal, which is the actionable form of Oela, which is the most revealing term in Yeshaya 17:6 prophecy. Speaks of those who were deliberately thrust aside and left behind by the Zeruah during Teruah, so that they could be the surviving remnant that is prepared to witness Yahweh's return. So as we consider what is revealed next, we have a number of options. And I think in this case, as we're going to learn and what we have already heard from Malachi, that Eleazar isn't an additional new individual who's going to magically appear. Eleazar, the one who is supported by God, is none less than Elia. So you should give that which is associated with her to Eleazar, the one supported by God, that is Elia, the one acting in the role of priest and royal advisor. He will bring her out, withdrawing and removing her, as in an exodus of God, a yasa, from out of the public space of the militant fighters laying siege. They will have slaughtered her, bludgeoning her without resistance. They will have beaten and killed her at this time, literally hammering her to death for having offered his life. In association with this, before his presence and in front of him. So this is a Nathan gift. The parah is offered to the surviving remnant of Israel. Therefore, he, like Moshe, would also precipitate a Yasa Exodus, this time removing the children of Israel from the horrible situation in which they find themselves. Therefore, this man, called Eleazar, God's assistant, as the mighty Elia, is tasked with this responsibility. And he's going to have God's support and involvement. The verb yasa, of course, should be very familiar to Jews because it's the one that Yahweh chose to use to designate the exodus from Mitzrayim this time. Israel is being drawn out of Babel, intermixing and confusing, commingling of religion and politics is so stained Israel today. Now at this point, the Adam, bloody red, Shekat, bludgeoned body of the Zeruah, which was Shekat, slaughtered in the presence of Satan, will have been tossed on the Adamah ground in public view out of animosity. And also as a trophy. It will be surrounded by sadistic militants, those who beat him to death while praising their wannabe God. Therefore, with Eleazar supported by the actual God, he is going to follow Yahweh's instructions, which are to remove the body from the belligerents. Now, I think that because Yahweh will have raised the Dome of the Rock and Alaska Mosque, remnant of Yisrael, Oela, left behind will likely be retrieving it from where the mosque once stood, overlooking the city of Dode. And it will then be moved to a less corrupted part of the mount, north towards where the temple once stood. And that's where this altar for the sacrifice bowl will be made. The Zeruah sacrificial death at the hands of those serving the beast is not going to be quick. It won't be painful. He will, Shekat, be beaten to death with something akin to hammers, clubs, crutches. And in this way, he will experience something similar to what Dode endured when whipped and crucified by Romans as an excruciating public spectacle. I've shared this before, but it's something that so few people recognize, and it sounds so shocking to our ears that I want to reinforce it. in the book of Ezekiel, which is Satan's autobiography and his playbook. He brags that he will take the life of this Gabor, this competent and courageous man of God. Then he boasts that he will eat his flesh and he will drink his blood during what I have called the Feast of the Beast. So I have known for some time that I would be on the menu. And this means that prior to being downgraded to a serpent, Satan was once, as he presents himself in Ezekiel, a cherub. And as a cherub, he would have been able to see his future, which he then shared with Ezekiel in Babylon. He knows this is going to occur. The ghoulish display of cannibalism and drinking blood, like all practicing Catholics, by this corporal manifestation of Halal ben Shakar, will be mostly symbolic. He's going to take one swig, one chomp. He's not going to care for it very much. His ego may be momentarily satiated, but Satan's going to walk away, leaving my body behind. And with Yahweh's assistance, that's going to make the animal parah retrievable. Now, this is something I want to leave this program with tonight, and then we'll pick it up from this point next week. There is a parallel to all of this, and it is introduced in the preparations for the initial feast in conjunction with the covenant. In Bereshit, Genesis 15:9, in advance of their first meal together in the Bereshit covenant, we read, "And he said to him," this is the Yahweh expressed to Abram, "obtain to approach me a heifer to establish a pattern that will repeat. Who is three, as well as third in the series, a helpful, strong, and steadfast goat? Who is three, as well as third in the series, and a ram? Who is three, as well as third in the series, in addition to a beloved bird, a tor, a turtle dove, serving as the base of Torah, and a thieving and vicious pigeon, a gozal, a young and immature nestling who is yet to emerge from the nest, lay eggs, or raise chicks. It's from guz, to set, to cut off, to pass over, and then pass away, and gazal, to shear off, mow down, and separate, and then destroy, by flailing a victim alive. It is symbolic of Yisrael's defiance and estrangement, as well as the Torahless one, known as Satan." Now, this is really a powerful and insightful prophetic statement at the onset of the covenant that tells us so much about what is taking place during the sacrifice of the red heifer. The Zeruah, now cast in the role of the Adam of Hurah, will be 3 years into his second life when this occurs. And the Zeruah is the third in a series of three Zeruah. He will be serving the Ael, the lamb, being extolled by the Ez goat. And he will be attacked by the Gazol for his love of Torah. Of Torah. Now, should anyone think that there's some overreaching here, contemplate this again. Not only are both stories presented in the Torah, recorded by the first Zeruah, the same bird will be deployed, lakash, to obtain and take. The purpose is also the same, which is to approach God, who is returning for his covenant family. Now, on the Teruah celebration of the Adam HaPerah, in just a matter of days. It's also to enjoy a celebratory meal. But it gets, of course, better, because the word chosen to convey heifer was Eglah, revealing two very essential insights. First, Yahweh was establishing a pattern of conduct that would repeat itself, coming full circle with respect to participating within the covenant. And second, by using Eglah to depict a heifer on the first occasion, when God spoke of a parah thereafter, something inherent in these words that is essential to understanding his explanation. And we found it in both. One is to establish a pattern that's going to repeat itself, and the other is one who is productive and fruitful in these harvests. Eglah affirms that the bereft will be reestablished through the heifer. And Parah reveals that on the final occasion, it will be through an Adam man who has been notably productive and fruitful, which is the very definition of Zeruah, and it speaks of the successful harvest of Shavuot and Zeruah. And of course, Yeshayahu led us to this prophecy using Parah in conjunction with the Zeruah's productivity on those mikreh. Even Shalosh, which means three and third in a series, is insightful because just as Dodo arrived 3 years before serving as the Passover lamb, Yad is going to return 3 years in advance of being sacrificed as the red heifer. And of course, Yad is the third and final Zeruah. Now there's a lesson even in the other animals. Yahweh specified a goat and a ram of the same age. Yahweh called the goat an Etz, which is written Ein Zain, just like Elazar, which is Ein Zain Rosh. Ez, in addition to goat, means physically and mentally strong, capable, and therefore helpful. Boy, that would describe Elia.
Mm-hmm.
The scapegoat, whose blood is spattered on the mercy seat, is an Azazel. It is derived from the verb Azab, which means to separate, forsake, and damn. El Azar concludes with a Rosh, which tells us that this particularly powerful and capable, strong and helpful man of God is observant and thoughtful. He is, therefore, Elia. Returning to the debut of the Eglah, the reoccurring heifer, foreshadowing Teruah, and the S, capable and influential goat, foreshadowing Kippurim, Yahweh added an Al ram, bringing his son, Dod, into the mix as the harbinger of Pesach, as the Pesach Al. They were all to be three and third in the series. And this is because all three men, Yada, Elia, Dod, the heifer, the goat, and the ram, would live three lives. Each claimed their part to fulfill three mikreh. And all three will have been brought back onto the scene 3 years in advance of their final mission. How's that for specificity? Each of the three would be cut in half, with Abraham passing between them, symbolizing how the covenant would be formed based upon what all three accomplished during their first two lives. But let's not leave out the tor, which is typically rendered as a turtle dove. We can't prove it. I suspect the tor, which when demarcated in the lexicons as feminine, is more correctly masculine because it is Torah without the feminine ah suffix. The verbal root tor, which is spelled identically in the text, means to seek, to find, and explore, which is what Moshe has facilitated through the Torah. Further, since the context here in Bereshit 15:9 and later in Kara Leviticus 12:6 depicts a symbolic animal, we find that tor is commonly rendered as a turtle dove. And as a bird, we're drawn right back to Moshe, because in Yeshayah Isaiah 63:13, a passage that we'll consider next week, the prophet not only designates Moshe as the first and foremost, actually the first of the three Zeruah, Dod was the foremost of them, he refers to him as a bird, as a swoosh, which is a skipping and swift swallow. Therefore, we might expect Tor is a term. It is a term of endearment. It is used in the Mizmor of Dode to describe his love for his people, Yehuda. Now, if Tor is addressing Moshe, his one long life was exemplary and endearing. And since he was retired after a job exceedingly well done, symbolically, at the inception of the covenant, he was not cut in two. And if Yehudim, in contrast to Yisrael, then of course it would be consistent with the fact that the very meaning of Yahud is beloved of Yah. Now, we had a chance today to investigate Gozal. And it turns out to be a fascinating term. You always have to be careful with any word that starts with a G in Hebrew. Mm-hmm. And this one's no exception. So it is a young, immature nestling who is yet to emerge from the nest, much less lay eggs or raise chicks. It is typically translated as a young pigeon, which, like the poor, isn't endearing. The most likely root is guts, which means to be cut off, pass over, and to pass away. Gozal is often associated with gazaz, which means to shear off, to mow down, and to cut off, then destroy. In Shaphat Judges 9:25, a picture is painted that is drawn of this gozal as people who lie in wait to rob those who come along on a road and who are unsuspecting. Now, this, along with this route, speaks of going well beyond merely stealing of the belongings and works of others, but doing so violently and forcibly, even to flail the victims alive. This flailing a victim alive is reflected in Micah 3:12, where the verbal root is to depict those who hate good and love evil to the extent that they tear the skin off of those who tell the truth. And this is what's actually going to happen to the Adam of Korah. Now, taking all of these things into consideration, the Gozal, immature pigeon, represents either Yisrael in context to Yahudah, or more likely, the Torahless one who will attempt to flay Yada as the red heifer alive on Teruah. That makes that initial menu of the first meal celebrated in the covenant rather prophetic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, that was one of my favorite experiences this morning as I went back to translate all of this. And it's one of the reasons why I wanted to reestablish our bearings with this, how we are led into the story of the Adam of Korah. We will recommence next week specifically on the what is now the fourth statement of Bamidbar Numbers in the wilderness, 19:4. We'll go through this story and we will buttress it by what D referenced in her song, which is the man from Edom, which speaks specifically of this sacrifice. And then as we complete the entire story of the Adam of Korah and what it means for the future of Yisrael, how it restores Yisrael back into fellowship with Yahweh, this remnant of mortals who will witness Yahweh's return with the Messiah Dode, then we will go into the dress rehearsal of this event, which it just shapes its very essence and meaning. So we will see what Eliyah did 2 millennia, 40 Yovel, 888 years prior to what he will do on Teruah, on the morning of Teruah, and year 6,000 Yah, just 9 years from now. The whole story, when woven together, it's just breathtaking. And then we recognize that it's the same story that restores Yisrael so that Dode can can be remarried to his beloved. So we have a lot in store, and it's beautiful the way that Yahweh has woven us together. Dee and my wife and I really had quite a go of it as we have considered all the related passages and shared our notes together and then gone off and done more translations and more analysis and more connected insights. Now, I've always said that knowledge was an exceedingly important thing, but understanding is the most powerful ingredient in the universe. And to go from knowing to understanding by making intelligent connections between things. And that is very much what we're doing. And what Yahweh does to tell the story of the red heifer. The red heifer is not an isolated event. It is woven right into the fabric of Yahweh's, of his mikre, and of his return, and how he prepares his people for the great homecoming. So with that, we'll say good evening this wonderful Shabbat to one and all. We look forward to being with you this time next week, and we will continue to celebrate Israel's victories on the battlefield while we know what awaits Israel in the days to come. May God will bless his people and his word and those in his covenant. Have a wonderful evening. Good night.
Yeah, okay. Good night.
Night.
And thank you again, Dee, for the song. We'll play it again next week.
Okay. Sounds good. Happy Shabbat.
Happy Shabbat.
Hey there. Will Wistia, the video platform built for business. With Wistia, you can...
Wistia.com/info.
That's WISTIA.com/info.
You slept through your alarm, missed the train, and your breakfast fingers.
Ugh.
Cold. Sounds like you could use some luck.
I'm Victoria Cash, and Lucky Land is where people go every day to get lucky. At Lucky Land, you can play over 100 casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Go to LuckyLandSlots.com and get lucky today.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.